good afternoon, Juno. It's a couple of seconds after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. Got a great lineup of guests telling us about some wonderful events that are coming up tonight and through the weekend. First off, in just a few minutes after National Native News, we'll be hearing from some folks that are involved in the UAS Honors Program. They have a special seminar coming up tonight that will bring 3 students who are attending high school here from countries Yemen, Bahrain, and Gaza joining us to tell us about that program tonight. Martin Luther King Day Jr. is on our Junior Day is on Monday, and Sherry Patterson will come in to tell us what's going on around town for that. The Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center Fireside Lecture Series continues. Tonight's speakers are Linda Kruger and Jim Powell. They'll be here to tell us what they're going to talk about. And it's LunaFest time once again. Carolyn Schultz and Lisa Egan Lagerquist will be here to tell us about the lineup of 9 films that will be shown at that. Right now it's time for National Native News. Stay tuned for the rest of Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In Canada, a sweatshirt worn by a Native teenager has stirred controversy. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, she wore it to school in Saskatchewan and was told it was offensive.
13-year-old Tanel Starr is with the Star Blanket First Nation. Her sweatshirt sparked a controversy when she wore it to school. It reads, "Got land?" on the front, and on the back it says, "Thank an Indian." Starr says officials at the school told her to remove it.
At first, I didn't know what's going on, and then they told me to remove my sweater because it was offending other people.
Starr says the sweatshirt speaks about First Nations treaties and land rights. Some people took offense, but the teenager refused to back down from her support for the slogan. After a meeting with her family and community members, the school later said she could wear the sweatshirt. Sheldon Poitras is a band counselor.
It's not meant to be confrontational. Like I said, it's a shock value type statement that says, hey, look, we're Native people. You know, there's a history as to why we're kind of on this territory together.
Meanwhile, the Winnipeg man behind the shirts with the Gotland slogan says his phone has been ringing off the hook with orders. He says he just wanted to bring awareness about Aboriginal issues and to unite his people and make them proud of who they are. He adds that Native people were in North America first, but shared their land and wanted everyone to prosper. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Law enforcement officers in Wyoming County are planning for extra security measures. The effort is in response to the distribution of Cobell settlement funds. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov reports.
The Cobell settlement for $3.4 billion is for the mismanagement of tribal royalties and land by the federal government. About $1.5 billion of that will be distributed, including 6,000 to 8,000 beneficiaries on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming. Lander Police Chief Jim Carey says some tribal members don't have bank accounts and could end up toting around a lot of cash, which has the potential to attract criminals to the community.
Violent crime is a concern for us. Obviously, the robbery aspect of it is truly a motivation for us to provide some extra protection.
Tribal members without bank accounts are also being encouraged to open one. For National Native News, I'm Irina Zhurov.
In South Carolina, a judge has dismissed contempt of court charges filed against the Cherokee father in the Baby Veronica case. But as KGOU's Kirk Gortney reports, a civil lawsuit remains unsettled.
The contempt case was dropped Thursday after Dustin Brown and the Cherokee Nation reached an agreement with Matt and Melanie Capobianco, who are the adoptive parents of now 4-year-old Veronica. Brown faced contempt charges after initially refusing to comply with a South Carolina judge's order to return Veronica to the Capobiancos. Last year, Brown gave Veronica to the couple after Oklahoma Supreme Court lifted an order keeping her in the state. Brown, with the support of the Cherokee Nation, argued he should have custody of his biological daughter under provisions of the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act. Despite that ruling, Brown is still not in the legal clear. The Capobiancos continue to seek more than $1 million in legal fees and expenses from Brown and the Cherokee Nation. That case remains pending in an Oklahoma court. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gortney.
This week, Dr. Vanita Chenault took the role of president at Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas. The Prairie Band of Potawatomi Nation member is a former student and has held various positions at the school for nearly 21 years. Her goals include generating revenue and helping Haskell continue to have an impact on Native students.
It does and has an amazing impact on our graduates. And, you know, it's like I'm committed to ensuring that that history and that tradition continues.
The tribal college enrolls more than 1,000 students a semester. Today we remember Honorary Chief Marie Smith Jones, who died in January 2008 in Alaska. She was the last speaker of the Eyak language. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org. Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC-CLIC-GIVE when filing online for your PFD. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska. Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My first two guests are here to tell us about a program which, I stand corrected, is on Wednesday, not tonight. So we'll talk about that. There's a couple of new things that are going on out at UAS, and for the last 2 years we've had an honors program. Saul Neely is here, and he is, the honors program coordinator, it says here. Mm-hmm. And also the fellow who is teaching the seminar, which is going to be part of it, is a public event that's coming up on Wednesday night. And, of course, that's Robin Waltz, who is history department?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you're most of the history department, I think.
I'm half of the history department on the Juneau campus. Anyway.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. And so you are now teaching some honors classes and like that?
Yes, this is a first for me. I'm teaching an honors class. It's called Pacific Peoples, Translocal Identities and Cultural Connections. Most of the focus is on Filipino and Pacific Islander communities.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
However, this next part of it that's coming up Wednesday night is
right.
A little distance from that, I think.
Yeah. Well, it requires some connection, some
yes.
connecting tissue, if you
so
will.
So make the connection.
Make the connection. Okay. This Wednesday, we're putting on a program called Translocal Students in Alaska, the YES Students in Alaska. That stands for Youth Exchange and Study. And it has to do with translocal Muslim identities around the world. And what that means is the YES program, and I know it's kind of hard politically to imagine these days with sort of like, you know, Democrats and Republicans not agreeing on anything, that in 2003, Ted Kennedy and Richard Lugar created this program called Youth Exchange and Study. That's what the YES stands for. And it has to do with bringing teenagers, ages 15 to 17, from predominantly Muslim countries to the United States for a year of essentially high school, wrapping up high school. And so it's one of those, you know, goodwill ambassador type of events. And three of those students, Maha Abdul Razak, is from Yemen and attending Thunder Mountain High School. Abdullah Hussein is from Bahrain, attending Juneau Douglas High School, and then Haitham Mohana from Gaza is attending Haines High School. So these are the three students who are going to be here on Wednesday evening. They're going to talk about themselves, their families, their background, and their experiences here going to high school in Alaska.
Now, 2 years ago, there was a seminar up on campus that involved some college-age exchange students who were all from Muslim countries, predominantly Muslim countries.
Okay.
And I remember I went to it, and it was an absolutely fascinating opportunity to really change your perspective on who these people are, because we see them in the news, and that's all of us know that's nothing having to do with reality.
No, that's really true.
And the reality of having them be people talking to us and like that, and being able to interact with them was really a wonderful opportunity for a lot of people. I think everyone who went to that enjoyed it immensely.
Sure, I think especially here in the United States, because I've been talking to my students. I've been teaching now for a few years, emphasizing that 23% of the world is Muslim, mm-hmm. right? But in the United States, Muslims constitute less than 1%. They're almost one, not quite 1% of the entire population.
Mm-hmm.
So in truth, in everyday contact. You know, we have very, very little contact with people from Muslim countries. Yeah, but we'll have more because of Asia, because of Asian immigration.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the world's Muslims live in Indonesia, Bangladesh, northern India, and Pakistan. That constitutes the largest group of Muslims in the world. So it's really an Asian religion even more than it's a Middle Eastern religion.
So this presentation on Wednesday night is part of a larger picture, which is this honors seminar that you're teaching in Pacific peoples.
That's right. And so let's see, I think the connections are two. One of them has to do with Islam being a trans, it sort of was the world's first widely dispersed world religion, all the way from West Africa, across the Middle East, and across northern India, Central Asia, Indonesia, and the islands. The Philippine Islands were settled as Muslim cultures before the Spanish arrived.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and today even, 5% of the Filipino population is still Muslim.
Yeah.
And twice as many Muslims live there as in all of the United States. So there are those connections there. There actually are these kind of connections to Pacific peoples, particularly those who inhabit the islands of the Pacific and Southeast Asia. Anyway, that's that.
I wanted to ask one more question about that. You've concentrated your remarks on the Muslim population,
yes.
But I'm assuming if you're teaching a seminar on Pacific peoples that it also brings in the rest, the other cultural aspects. And
oh, it absolutely does. In fact, that's really the focus. This was just kind of an opportunity that came our way. It was like, these students are here, and do you think there could be a place for them, you know, at UAS? And we said, sure, and we'll work them into the seminar, you know. But no, absolutely. The focus of the seminar is really on our Filipino and Pacific Islander communities, and when we get to our symposium, you'll be inviting us back.
Because
in early March, we're going to have a symposium, and we've got a great lineup of speakers.
I'm looking forward to it. Is this the annual, the UAS has run an annual seminar on a particular international relations topic each year. Is this the one that's coming up, Saul?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
So last year was our inaugural Spring Honors Symposium, and it was really successful and very meaningful for the students who participated in it. It was on transgenerational suffering, focusing on historical violence, memory, and repair. And we had about 10 days worth of events, including film screenings, speakers, renowned speakers coming up, presentations by the honor students. And we're sort of duplicating a number of those kinds of features, but in new and sort of singular ways. And Robin's put a lot of great work into integrating the work that the students are doing at the Honors Reading Seminar into the community and really getting this community engagement down, because it's certainly one of the values of UAS.
Well, Saul, you've had a chance and an opportunity here to kind of be the developer of an honors program which didn't exist a couple of years ago at
right.
UAS. This is a really new thing for us. Can you tell us a little bit about the nature of the honors program?
Yeah, it's a pretty exciting ordeal. There's a set of core requirements that all the students have to accomplish, and then we have two different tracks. We have one that sort of goes towards more quantitative study, and we call that science, society, and the environment. And then we have one that's more sort of qualitative study, concerned with languages and cultures, and a lot of Alaska Native Studies work as well. We have a specific Alaska Native Studies track within that part of the honors program. So we have probably about 15 students working in it right now, and they're just great, a great group of students, a good cohort, and they're doing a lot of really good work.
What are the entrance requirements into the honors program?
There's no formal application process. We don't really want to have too severe of a gate, you know. But students have to have a 3.5 GPA, and they have to...
That's basically a B+, is what a 3.5 translates out to.
Sure.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And they have to enroll in the fall honors orientation class. It's just one credit, so I taught that last semester again. And then they go move from that into the one credit honors reading seminar. And I taught that last semester, and Robin is teaching it this semester. And then there's a year language requirement everybody has to fulfill minimally, some honors integrated coursework and participating in events such as this. Research and creative expression is a big part of the program as well, and really trying to hook students up with the resources that they need to have these sort of enhanced opportunities for educational leadership. So,
mm-hmm. Well, Robin, Saul, once more, the event that is open to the public.
Right.
Is on Wednesday, January 22nd. There's a reception at 5:30 in the evening, and this is all held at the UAS Rec Center, where there's plenty of room and nice setup down there for a public presentation.
Yeah, right. We're going to have nibbles, and then the students will speak at 6 o'clock.
Okay. And then the whole thing's pretty much over at 7, but that'll probably be the opportunity to maybe mingle and meet some of the students and like
absolutely.
That. Yeah. Nice, fairly casual setup, but presentations from a student attending Thunder Mountain High School from Yemen, a student attending Juno Douglas High School from Bahrain, and a student from Gaza attending Haynes High School, all of whom will be as part of the Pacific Peoples Translocal Identities and Cultural Connections Seminar that is being taught by Professor Robin Waltz out at the University of Alaska Southeast.
Sure, thanks. And well, for just one quick more little pitch, and then a little later that week on Saturday, in cooperation with the Goldtown Nickelodeon, we're going to screen the documentary Wayfinders, A Pacific Odyssey. This has to do with the rebirth of Polynesian sailing techniques. Mm. It's a marvelous documentary. It's free. It's at 4:30 in the afternoon. They're going to squeeze it in between two screenings of Nebraska, which is really nice of them, and really nice of Colette. And so it's at 4:30. It's an hour. It's going to be a nice, and we'll have discussion afterwards about what we saw.
I can see we're going to have you back for a number of events here to tell us about these things. Thank you so much. So one more time, that's at 4:30 on
Saturday,
January 25th at the Goldtown Nickelodeon. The movie's called Wayfinders, A Pacific Odyssey. Sounds fascinating.
It is.
Okay, yeah. Well, thank you, folks, for coming down and talking.
Thanks, Pat.
This is Bird Note. The Yellow Sea coast of the Korean Peninsula is one of the few places on Earth where spoon-billed sandpipers can still be found. Bird Note's Adam Sedgley joined Cornell Lab of Ornithology multimedia producer Garrett Vinn to photograph and record these critically endangered shorebirds. They found the sandpipers resting and feeding en route from their nesting grounds in Siberia to their wintering habitat in Southeast Asia. Here's Adam.
So during peak migrations in the spring and fall, a single mudflat on the Yellow Sea can have flocks of tens of thousands of shorebirds of different species. And when you're tasked with finding a single species that has a global population of only a few hundred birds, and where only a handful would be present at any time at any single location, the challenge is like finding a very rare needle in a feathery and constantly moving haystack. A couple hours before high tide, Garrett would set up a camouflage tent near the high water mark and wait for the water to gradually push the birds up the beach. I had a spotting scope in the grass behind him, and I was constantly scanning the incoming flocks of shorebirds to find a spoonie. I'd use a radio to communicate the movement of the birds to Garrett. Garrett would also go out on the mudflats at low tide, up to a mile out. I'd radio the direction, and he'd slowly approach the birds in the thick mud on his stomach.
See some of Garrett Vinn's intimate, eye-level portraits of the rare spoon-billed sandpiper at our website, birdnote.org.
We're going to give this next lady her own show on KTOO. She's here enough. Sherry Patterson is here, and Sherry's going to tell us about the events that are coming up in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. on Monday.
Yes. Hi.
Yeah. Hi. Welcome back.
Thank you. Yeah. So nice to be here. Thank you for inviting us. Yes, we're having our annual Dr. Martin Luther King community celebration of his birthday, which is a national holiday. And we will be celebrating at 1 o'clock p.m. Monday, January 20th at St. Paul's Catholic Church. And we have a fantastic lineup of speakers and singers. So we have quite a bit that we're doing, and just invite everybody to come out and take a lesson and celebrate with us.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes.
So that's the main event. Are there other things going on around the
community? You know, I have heard of a few other things, but nobody's gotten in contact with us. You know, the plan is every year is to try to have a listing of all of the activities that might be going on in celebration of that day, but we haven't reached that point yet. So I can promote only this one that I know of. Yes.
I know Fresh Air's broadcast on Monday is going to be centered on Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they mentioned on there is that this year is the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act.
Okay.
So that will probably play a role in national celebrations.
Right,
right.
I missed that one.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Well,
I think I missed that one.
Of us did.
Yes,
but quite an interesting thing.
Yes.
So who all is involved in planning all of these events?
Well, this particular event is sponsored by the Black Awareness Association, which I am president.
Uh-huh.
And plan this event every year for the community, and it is an event that the community loves and supports. And we have several diverse speakers, as we did last year, and the audience just loved it. So we thought we'd do the same thing this year, because in mm-hmm. past years we just had like a keynote speaker, and but they seem to like the shorter several diverse personalities to come and share. And and this year we are doing the same thing. We have Lisa Toll, former Lisa Cooper, who is one of our local vocalists. She'll be singing.
Mm-hmm.
I will be singing. And we have another young lady, Jocelyn Miles, and Latroy Burrows. He's going to do something for us. And the speakers, Kim Kiefer, our city manager, is going to come and greet the audience. And then we have Sally Smith, we have Frida Westman, Bill Martin, Dan Larson, Nathal Sims, Lupita Alvarez, and then we have Dan Weiss as a local clergy that's going to come and round it out for us.
Do you have a sense of what these individual speakers are going to?
We ask each one to come and just give homage and a tribute, a personal tribute to Dr. King in their own way.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Are there things that you do on Martin Luther King Day? Are there remembrances, personal remembrances that you yourself do other than organizing this thing?
Organizing this have been just a part of what I do in
uh-huh.
past years. We have, because it's also considered nationally a day of service, and we have gone, you know, to, and this has been quite some time ago, just haven't done it, gone to Glory Hole or some other community organization to see if there's something that can be done to help out.
Yeah.
Yes. We'll probably need to get back to that.
I think all of us say that at
yes.
one point or another.
Yes.
We need to
yes.
organize ourselves and get
right.
down to the glory
yeah.
hole and cook one night.
Right. And, you know, we might not do it on this particular day,
mm-hmm.
especially
because of this particular event.
Yeah. But through the year, you know, I believe in my community, and I give back through the whole year. Yes.
There is mm-hmm. such a sense of that in Juneau.
Yes, it is.
I've remarked on that a lot of times. We have a really incredibly rich cultural
yes,
heritage
we, yes,
here,
we
but
do.
We also have this necessity
yes.
to take care of ourselves and to take care of our brothers and sisters because we are isolated to the degree that all of us have experienced the empty shelves at the grocery stores
mm-hmm.
on the days the barges are a couple
Correct.
Of hours
yes.
late.
Yes.
And so this business of increasing our resiliency by holding each other's hands, I think, is
right.
really important in this,
right.
in this kind of isolation.
Right. Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
I have one of Dr. King's quotes here. It says, "A good neighbor looks beyond the external accidents and discerns those inner qualities that make all men human and therefore brothers."
Mm-hmm.
And I can say, you know, in our community, we have a sense of brother and sisterhood. We take care of each other, you know, and I know of many incidences where people have been in need and the community just
yeah.
comes around them. And
well, we just went through the Thanksgiving and Christmas drives
That's
for
right.
giving meals to people
yes.
and like that.
Yes.
But it's extremely important. Those annual givings are incredibly powerful.
Right.
But the need is 24/7, 365.
Correct. That's
and
right.
So
That's
as you were saying,
right. yes.
Martin Luther King Day is a wonderful day of national service, but every day of the year
every
has to be
day.
A day of national
That's
service
right.
or there's someone out there
Absolutely.
Who is going to go without.
That's right. That's right.
I agree with you totally.
Yes.
I'm really proud so many times of the power of this community to respond to those kinds of needs
right.
and
yes.
hold out a helping hand.
Yes, yes, yes.
So
yes.
once again, mm-hmm. times and places.
Okay. We are meeting at St. Paul's Catholic Church on Monday. This is coming up in a couple days, January 20th, 2014, at 1 o'clock p.m. for the annual Dr. Martin Luther King community celebration of his birthday.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much
thank
for coming
you
down,
so much.
Sharing, and we'll see you again, I am sure.
Yes, thank you so much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 17th of January, 2014. It's the birthday of the youngest of the Bronte sisters, Anne Bronte, born in Thornton, Yorkshire, 1820. She was a shy young woman, especially close to her sister, Emily. They made up stories together. When she was 19, she took a job as a governess and 6 years later returned home and began writing. Her first novel, Agnes Grey, sold pretty well in 1847, and her second, The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, 1848, was a big hit. Within the next year, three of the four Bronte siblings, Emily, Anne, and their brother Branwell, died of tuberculosis. Anne was the last of the three to die, and as she died, she whispered to her sister Charlotte, "Take courage." It's the birthday of the poet William Stafford, born Hutchinson, Kansas, 1914, author of many books of poems, a conscientious objector during the Second World War. He was interned as a pacifist in civilian public service camps, Arkansas, California, fighting fires, building roads. He wrote about it in his memoir, Down in My Heart. And it's the birthday of Michelle Obama, born Michelle Robinson in Chicago, 1964, grew up on the south side of Chicago. Her father worked for the city water plant. She skipped the second grade, went to the first magnet high school in Chicago, ranked second in her graduating class, went off to Princeton, then to law school at Harvard, and met Barack Obama at the law firm in Chicago, where they both worked. It's the birthday of Benjamin Franklin, born Boston, 1706. Only had 2 years of formal schooling, but he read a lot and read early on the essays of Joseph Addison and Richard Steele. And he said in his autobiography, "Writing well became of great use to me in the course of my life and was a principal means of my advancement." He wrote under the pen name Richard Saunders, Poor Richard's Almanac. It came out for 26 years, weather predictions, household hints, poetry, essays, and adages, such as "Married in haste, we often repent at leisure," and "Where there's marriage without love, there will be love without marriage." Here's a poem for today by Dana Gioia, New Year's. Let other mornings honor the miraculous. Eternity has festivals enough. This is the feast of our mortality, the most mundane and human holiday. On other days, we misinterpret time, pretending that we live the present moment. But can this blur, this smudgy in-between, this tiny fissure where the future drips into the past, this fly speck we call now, be our true habitat? The present is the leaky palm of water that we skim from the swift, silent river slipping by. The new year always brings us what we want, simply by bringing us along to see a calendar with every day uncrossed, a field of snow without a single footprint. New Year's, a poem by Dana Gioia from Interrogations at Noon, published by Gray Wolf Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily online workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and are dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's just about 29 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO in Juneau, Alaska.
Alaskans who experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and mental health conditions are important members of the state's workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are succeeding in the workplace. The trust encourages Alaska employers to consider ways in which trust beneficiaries and their unique skills can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. Support comes from Valley Medical Care, offering a team of physicians and nurse practitioners committed to healthy newborns, toddlers, teens, and adults in Southeast Alaska, and proud to support public radio.
Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. My next two guests are here to tell us about a really fascinating study that they've been involved with in Yakutat, Angoon, and Prince of Wales. U.S. Forest Service social scientist Linda Kruger is here, and UAF research fellow Jim Powell is here as well. And the two of them have been basically studying how people on those three in those three locations observe and adapt to environmental and climate changes. They're going to give a stand-up presentation tonight at 6:30 and then repeated at 8 o'clock out at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitors Center as part of the Fireside Lecture Series. Which always offers a wonderful opportunity to kind of find out things about the world around us here in Southeast Alaska. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Pat.
Thanks for inviting us.
Great to be here.
So we were just saying before I opened the mics that most of the time when I'm talking to someone who's going to give a fireside lecture out there, I'm talking about talking to people who've been watching polar bears or something like that. But you actually did your research on people.
And you know, it's a hard act to follow. I heard wonderful things about the polar bear talk last week, and it's going to be a hard act to follow.
Truly wonderful, yeah.
We hope to see folks out there tonight. I know there's a lot of competition. There's a lot of things happening around town, but we're really looking forward to seeing a good turnout.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about the structure of this study.
Well, first of all, you mentioned I work for the Forest Service. I work out at the Juneau Forestry Sciences Lab, and the federal government, and particularly the Forest Service, has a really unique relationship with federally recognized tribal entities. And so we have a responsibility to consult with tribes on programs and policies, including research. And so in addition to consulting with tribes, we work with them to try to identify opportunities to collaborate. and where we can accomplish more by working together on projects that will benefit the agency as well as the tribes, and particularly that engage people in the communities and youth and elders with researchers, so that students maybe consider studying science and math and resource management, and then maybe will be available to intern with the Forest Service or end up in a career in natural resource management. And so we try to identify opportunities to get out into community and have one-on-one experiences with people and youth out in the communities. And so this project was an opportunity to get out into different areas. And Jim had just finished up his PhD at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and was going to be available to work on some projects. And I said, Jim, how about joining me in this study? And so it's been wonderful. It's been a really good partnership, and I'll let Jim talk about the study and what we've done so far.
Jim?
The study, I think, is interesting because the University of Alaska Fairbanks and others have been putting a lot of time into the natural systems, like you said. You know, we look at the bears, we look at the glaciers, and there's a lot of information and a lot of science on that. And looking at the whole state, there's been a lot done in the northern parts and the western part of Alaska with people also, because you've heard about climate change and erosional problems and communities actually having to move inland because of climate change. There hasn't been so much on the social side, the human side in Southeast. So that's why University of Alaska Fairbanks was interested in Linda and her proposal to do research on what are humans, what are people in communities seeing? What are we observing as far as climate change and environmental change? What's happening down there? So what we did was we said, okay, we're going to look at the region. We don't have enough resources to ask everybody. So we did a demographic kind of research approach. And we knew that we thought, you know, subsistence was important. People that are gather, there was an assumption in the research that they're close to the resources. So that went into where do we go? So we decided to go to the communities that have high percentage of native populations. So we went to we selected, and we also wanted a demographic switch. I mean, Southeast Alaska is big.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a big area. So we decided to go north, Yakutat, Angoon, which has the highest percentage of natives in all of Southeast Alaska, then also Prince of Wales. So we have a north, a middle, and a south represented. So then we went into the communities, and we first thing you do is you ask permission. You're dealing with human systems and communities and tribal entities, so we went in and we asked for permissions, and thank God they said, okay, come on in and start doing your research. So that's what we did. And we basically collected data. We collected almost 100 interviews over a period of a year last year. We went to those three areas and collected information. Did interviews. We taped them, videoed them, and right now, after we've collected them, we're just starting to look at it, and we have some patterns and some trends that we'd like to share with people. And then hopefully next year we'll have some edited video that we can show more people. But that's all contingent upon tribal approval, too. So we try to be sensitive towards people and communities, and researchers don't always have that opinion or approach.
Sensitivity, yeah.
So we want to leave the communities with something that they can archive and have. So that's also our approach, too. And we're finding things. And it's going to be interesting, and that's what I'm going to show tonight, is a table of what the science says, the natural sciences. And the natural sciences are intense in their approach, but they're sporadic, you could even say.
When you say the natural sciences, you're talking about climatology.
I'm talking about the physical sciences,
okay,
more,
all right.
Biology, the things that you would measure if you were out there as a science if you didn't ask people what they were observing. So I'm comparing what we saw, the observations from humans, because they have local knowledge. They're there, they live there, they live it, they've been there for years. And we're going to compare that with what the science is saying. So that's one of the things that we're going to share tonight.
I think one other thing that I would say is this kind of work, you know, it's impossible to do unless you have the cooperation and the buy-in from the local people. And we just were so well received in all of the communities. You know, they were so welcoming to us for the times that we spent there and interested in what the questions we were asking and being part of the study. And so that's always really, really helpful when you want to do this kind of work, to have community participation and engagement and support for being part of your study.
Can you give me an idea of who you chose to be to interview? How was the what was the selection process?
Well, it was opportunistic, you would say. We interviewed who we could. We did take a we did take a random sample in Goon. That was a little different because Fish and Game, and I should credit Fish and Game. We, going into the study, we wanted to collaborate with different people, and as you know, as a former researcher yourself, you bring in a lot of people to bear to check to make sure what you're doing and get the knowledge of people. So people at the university here at UAS, we ask questions of, you know, who has done this before? Has anybody done this before? So what we did was we went in and we found out that Fish and Game was doing these household subsistence surveys. And they've done that over, oh, God, from the 70s.
Right.
That's some of the richest information I have ever seen. Fish and Game goes into households and asks them, you know, what are you catching? What are you hunting? And there's like 20 pages. And thank God they're still receptive to giving that information, with all the conflicts on resource use and everything. But anyway, we heard that they were going into Angoon and doing one. Well, they do pure random samples of the population. And I was able to piggyback on that. In fact, we were able to, and thank God Fish and Game agreed to do this, is to put two questions on their interview, which is wonderful. So we piggybacked on top of their surveys, actually, and we also were using some of their information as we went into Angoon. So we asked people as best we could. It was what you would call snowballing technique, if you're familiar with that.
Yeah.
One would lead to another to another. At first, it's very difficult because people are reticent about, you know, we have another researcher coming into the community. Oh, boy. But as trust builds and over time, it gets easier. So you need to go to the communities over and over again as they trust you and share more information.
Linda, had you done work in these three places before?
You know, no, I haven't. I had lived in Juneau in the 80s, but I did my my PhD work down at the University of Washington, and I've worked in rural communities and done this kind of research in rural communities in Washington State, but not up here in Alaska. And I'd been to Yakutat before. I'd never been to Angoon, and so it was a new experience to actually be in Angoon and to spend any time in Yakutat. So it was a pretty new experience for me to be out there.
I'm curious, can you contrast briefly the differences between doing this kind of research in Washington State and doing it here?
Well, a lot of it's logistics. In Washington State, obviously, you drive to where you're going to be. A lot of times you can get home or get to a facility. Out here, for example, flying to both Yakutat and Angoon, we were really fortunate to be able to stay in Forest Service bunkhouses, so we had a place to stay. But, you know, getting out there, it means flying, you know, getting an airplane ticket and flying out. And so just the logistics of doing research in Alaska is really challenging and expensive. And I know coming back, we had issues with weather. We came back from Angoon a day early on the ferry because we weren't going to be able to fly back because the weather was turning so bad. So there's those kinds of just the logistics of living in Southeast Alaska make doing research here more challenging.
The other part that's really cool about doing research is there's in Southeast Alaska and other communities too in Alaska, but in Southeast we're real close physically.
Yeah.
So I can go to Angoon. I don't need a truck. Mm-hmm. I can walk around. I can see people. So there's a theory of closeness. Even in Juneau, you know, downtown, you're running into each other. You share.
Right.
You network.
Yeah.
So we have high, I think, there's a high level of human capital in the sense that we're social. We're sharing information. So that makes it easier. You can find out what's going on in the community very, very quickly. You can walk. It's really, that's
yeah.
A lot of fun.
I think also Southeast Alaska is a big community. And so I think that opens the doors to people more so than down south in bigger communities or, you know, even rural communities there, you know, coming in from Seattle. It's just like there's some suspicion where, you know, Jim and I are both here from Southeast. We've been in Southeast for a long time. And so there's some acceptance there that makes it a lot easier to get into people's homes and have them tell you personal stories, which is what's really important.
So tonight people get an opportunity to hear about your research. Can you give me just a very brief idea of what they're going to, what's the experience going to be for folks who come up at 6:30 or 8 o'clock?
Well, the first question we asked of the folks that we interviewed was, are you seeing anything? What are you seeing?
What changes are you
seeing? What changes are you seeing?
Okay.
And the answer is yes. And people from the north would probably,
and so you're going to present some of those answers tonight.
We're going to present it.
Yeah, with video or
no, we don't.
Oh, okay.
And because that needs to be approved by the local council, and it hasn't been done yet.
Okay.
But I can share some patterns, and there are patterns. There's patterns of weather.
Yep.
Weather's changing. There are changes in the way people are adapting because you have to adapt. They aren't big dramatic changes, but there are changes. And that's kind of cool because that lines up with some of the stories and some of the science that's out there too.
This is an opportunity to hear about some really unique research. Linda Kruger and Jim Powell are going to give their presentations tonight. This is the standard format at the Fireside Lecture. The program is put on at 6:30, and then they clear away the room and kind of everybody comes back or some people will show up again. And at 8 p.m. there's a repeat of the same exact presentation that you heard at 6:30. So this is Southeast Alaska Residents Observations of Environmental and Climate Changes by a couple of folks who did the research and are going to come in and tell us about the patterns and findings that they've been exploring in the first parts of their findings. Thank you so much for alerting everyone to this opportunity, folks. Tonight, 6:30 or 8 o'clock out at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center.
That'll be great. We hope to see a big turnout. Thanks,
you
Pat.
Bet, thanks.
You teach him to respect the land. You teach him to respect the game. You teach him to respect the sea. And to respect his culture. But are you teaching him to respect women? Real Alaska men choose respect.
Brought to you by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Thank you.
about 11 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next guest is responsible, I just found out, for having brought, for the seventh time now, the Luna Fest to Juneau. And this is the Luna part of this is the Luna Bars, but the money primarily goes to cancer research and a little bit to the local organization. And this is a set of films about and by women's issues that shows around the country. There are 9 films in the sequence, and this is tonight, right?
Tonight,
yeah,
yep.
At Centennial Hall.
Yes.
And there's a number of things involved in this presentation. There are these 9 great films, mm-hmm. Which we will talk about in a moment. But there's also some other pieces that are pieces of the program that you're putting on tonight, right?
Yes, starting at 6 o'clock is the silent auction. This is all at Centennial Hall, and we have a variety of items at the silent auction. There's 2 dinners that you can bid on, a children's painting, services like drywall services, 3 hours of drywall services, jewelry, clothing, scarves, lots of kitchen items. So that's at 6, and at 6:30 the show starts. We have a great MC, Sharon Gateman, mm-hmm. and she will introduce our guest speaker, which only will speak about 5 minutes or less.
Who's your guest speaker?
Christy Erickson.
Okay.
She will be great. And then we will show the films until halfway through. There'll be an intermission with fabulous door prizes and more bidding on the silent auction items. And then we'll see the second half. And we expect it will be over around 8:30.
So what time is Granny's Got Game going to be on screen?
Granny's Got Game is the first show, which I was very lucky to get to preview these. Granny's Got Game, a film about an over 70-year-old women's basketball team, will probably start about 6:45.
There's a trailer out on your website. When you go out looking, if you Google LunaFest, they have a wonderful trailer that ties pieces out of all of the films. These women are fierce. I mean, we ain't talking about just paddling the ball around the court. These ladies go after it.
Oh, they do.
They do, indeed.
And hearing their story, and you know, it's over 70, so some of them are not just 70, but quite a bit over, and they are still out there playing basketball, and they are there to win.
Yeah.
And I am very inspired by them. Just like every year when I watch the LunaFest films, they're memorable and they're inspirational, and they make you think.
Yeah, well, these ladies definitely make you think. They're a marvelous bunch of basketball players, and it's worth watching them go after each other or go after the other team. Anyway, but you have a number of other really excellent films here. Date with Fate by Venetia Taylor.
Yes, that one is going to be in the second half, and I don't want to say too much about that one because, like a couple of these films, the ending is not necessarily what you're expecting and really something to see.
So the topic is blind dating, mm-hmm. but we'll leave it at that.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. First Match by Olivia Newman.
That one, when you see that film, you are going to remember it for quite a few years. It's about a girl, female wrestler, who's on an all-male wrestling team. And in the beginning, she's not very supportive, and then some pretty interesting things happen, and her team, well, I think I'll let you come see the film mm-hmm. on that one, too.
Flying Anne by Katherine Van Kampen.
That's about a young girl with Tourette's syndrome, and it's really awesome to see how she deals with the effects of Tourette's syndrome, and it sort of shows how she blossoms and how other kids come to accept her. And I think that could be really great for parents and for teenagers just to watch that and get a better idea of what it's like to be different and not being able to do anything about it.
2 films from other places or about people from other places. Maria of Many by Alexander Liveras.
Mm-hmm. That one is about a Mexican immigrant worker in the United States, and it's a very inspiring film of how people can overcome challenges.
And Running Dry by Dimitra Nicolopoulou.
Yes.
And
this is how a woman is impacted about the economic hardships in Greece. And one thing I'll say about this one is subtitled, and there you have to read fast. but it is so comical. I was laughing a lot when I watched it.
Okay, animated film Sidewalk by Celia Bullwinkle.
That's a brief film. I don't think there's any words. I could be wrong, but it shows a woman from, I think, almost birth to the end of her life and the changes she makes. Very entertaining.
Hmm. Sound Shadows, interesting sounding film by Julie Engoss.
Yes, and this, again, really made me think because it's basically of a woman who is blind. And to think about someone who's blind being able to make a film is pretty amazing because film, you mostly think of sight. And yet this is, I think it's made by someone who is blind.
Hmm.
So it's very interesting, again, and thinking about a world that is very different than anything I know.
And then an interesting film with a kind of a love plot to it, Tiny Miny Magic. Danielle Laurie is the director.
Yes, and this is another delightful film which has a little bit of a twist ending that I don't think anyone will guess. So I don't have to worry about giving it away. Very entertaining, just cute and a lighthearted, that it's sort of a nice way to end. It's our last film. And some of the films can be a little bit heavy, and so it's very nice that they're ending with this delightful film. It has to do with a postman.
It has to do with a postman. Okay, excellent. Okay, so 9 films, guest speaker, program starts at 6:30. Is that right?
Yeah, yes, the show will start at 6:30, silent auction at 6. And one other thing I would just like to say, sometimes people hear films for, by, about women, and men think, oh, I don't want to go. But almost every time I'm sitting next to a man in the audience, lots of men go, and they're laughing or crying or whatever. So men, please come. We encourage you to come just as well as the women.
Okay. So LunaFest is tonight at Centennial Hall. Come on, support this fine organization. As we said, the money is primarily collected to go toward breast cancer research. And
15% of the proceeds, or $250, whichever is more, goes to Breast Cancer Fund.
Uh-huh.
And the other part goes to the Juno Pro-Choice Coalition.
Right. Okay. So an excellent opportunity to view films about and by women. Date with Fate, First Match, Flying Anne, Granny's Got Game, Maria of Many, Running Dry, Sidewalk, Sound Shadows, and Tiny Miny Magic, all tonight. Thank you so much for doing this for the last 7 years, I guess. Our coordinator is Lisa Egan Lagerquist, and she's been here to tell us about this. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Monday is Martin Luther King Day. A little appropriate music here. Sweet Honey and the Rock. Oh, amazing group. It's about a minute and a half before 4 o'clock, we'll be up for the news in just a second here. Quick look at the forecast tonight. We're looking at increasing clouds with rain developing late, low around 37. Saturday, rain in the morning, and then rain showers in the afternoon. Highs Saturday around 43, southeast winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Saturday night, rain showers likely. Sunday, partly cloudy with a chance of rain. Sunday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain. And then on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we're looking at mostly cloudy weather with a chance of rain and highs around 41. Monday's program for Juno Afternoon will be a perspective program. We're looking at the first 20 years of jazz and classics, the festival from KTOO's archives, in part of the celebration of KTOO's 40th anniversary. This is KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on a set of translators throughout the area. In the Valley in Auk Bay, you can tune to K276AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, it's K269AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K21AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Straits, you can hear KTOO on K210AS at 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. KRNN can be heard on digital channel 872. And KXLL can be found on digital channel 873. We are also online at www.ktoo.org.